Okay, looks like the VCWG crowd is showing up. So with that, let me go and get started on the boilerplate stuff so we can move on to the regular content. So today we're going to be talking about data shards and solid VC through the lens of two advanced reading topic papers for rebooting. We saw these come over the threshold for rebooting, which is next week, and we thought they were a good continuation of the data storage hubs conversation that Kim kicked off for us a couple weeks ago. So that's a short version of the agenda. Regarding IP, if you are not a member of the working group, please become one. When you join, you sign a collaborative agreement that cleans up any intellectual property issues we might have. If you're not a member and you haven't signed that agreement, please hold your contributions to I don't even know how to say this right. We can't consider substantive contributions for folks who have not joined the group. We do use IRC to manage the queue, but we run the meeting based off of the voice call. If you can only join by our IRC, by all means, we'd be happy to get your comments over there. But do put yourself on the queue so that we can maintain one conversation as we move forward. Okay, so we also use a human scribe in IRC to keep track of the conversation. And at this point, I would like to see if we have anyone who would like to be a scribe for today. We keep a list of folks who've done it, so you get credit. So we'll go through in reverse order of folks who haven't done it in a while. Oh, and one of them, funnily, is Chris. So Ben Young, you're first on the list. I don't know if you're here. Chris, you're second, but since you're going to be presenting one of them, I don't want to. That's certainly not going to work when you're presenting. Is Dan Pape here? Chris, I'll take you up on that. Let's see if we can get someone who can pinch hit for Chris. So thank you, Chris. And I'll give you credit maybe towards the end of the scribe list. Is there someone who could chip in for the 10 or 15 minutes that Chris is presenting on data shards? Amy, excellent. Thank you. You were close, Chris. I'm not sure what the right syntax is. Someone can hook up Chris with the Scribnik. Either work. Okay, great. All right, so thank you, Chris and Amy, for helping out with the Scribe today. Okay, introductions and reintroductions. Do we have anyone new today? Someone who hasn't been on the call yet? We would love to get a very brief introduction just so folks know who you are.
I guess that would be me.
Okay, great. And who's that?
This is Serge. I work with Chris on a number of projects, but particularly data shards.
Okay, very cool. Welcome, Chris.
Serge.
Anyone else? I'm sorry,
Yes.
Serge. Yeah, well, Chris is Chris Weber, of course. Welcome, Serge. Okay, anyone else who's new today?
Hey, this is Ori Steele from Transmute.
Okay, welcome. Tell us a little bit about Transmute.
We're DIF members. We work on decentralized identity with Ethereum and verifiable credentials. Really big fans of the JSON linked data signature library from Digital Bazaar. Main reason for joining the call today is around the context for JSON linked data signatures and community public key format support.
Okay, great. Glad to have you. Okay, anyone else who's new? Okay, and since we had two new ones, I'll give a short call. Anyone who's been around a while who would like to reintroduce themselves? Not sure what that list looks like. Actually, Chris, curiously enough, you're at the top of that list as well. So since you're going to be leading one of the sections, why don't you reintroduce yourself?
Okay, Amy, if you don't mind scribing. So I'm Chris Weber. I work on, sometimes I contract for Digital Bazaar, but I otherwise also just work on a bunch of things independently in this space. I work on decentralized social networks like ActivityPub and stuff, and because of that, I've gotten into stuff like JSON-LD, and I've been interested in how credentials affect that work. And I've been part of the Rebooting Web Trust community as well for a couple of years. And I don't know if I say any more, I'll just keep rambling.
All right. Well, thank you, Chris. And we'll be handing the mic over to you in just a few minutes. Okay, announcements and reminders. So do we have Drummond or Marcus? We have been having a regular call on Thursdays to focus on DID resolution and DID spec as we wind up and hand off the work to the DID working group. These are still going on, Marcus?
I see you're here. Yes, we spent the last two calls focusing on some very deep topics related to DID resolution. We'll have to call again this week, not next week because of rebooting, but in general, we're still having the weekly calls.
Excellent. So the Zoom information is in the agenda. I'll go ahead and copy and paste it over here. If folks want to join, that's Thursdays at 90 minutes starting at 1 p.m. Pacific, which is 8. Is that right? 8 p.m. UTC?
Yes, that's right. We decided on the last call to shorten them to 60 minutes from now on.
Okay, great. I will update that in our future announcements. Okay, next up, DID Working Group Charter and Outreach. Manu, you want to speak to that for a second? We still have a short window to get some public support there. Is that correct?
Manu's not on the call.
Oh, he's just an IRC. Is there anyone else who can speak to that process? I guess I can. I don't know the specific deadline, although it's probably
Dan Burnett on the queue.
Okay, go ahead, Dan.
Yes. So the call for responses, basically votes for up or down for the DID Working Group Charter. Runs through the end of this month. So if you are an advisor committee representative for your company, then you should respond to that questionnaire. There is a link that Joe dropped in IRC, which is the email announcing the work. And so if you are not with a W3C member company, we would still very much appreciate if you would send a response to that public, that call for public comments as well, which is what Joe sent in IRC. It's really helpful to have comments in support of the work from both members and non-members. Thank you.
Thanks, Dan. Here's a slightly more specific link. I guess the link I dropped was the index for the month. That's the URL to the specific email went out. So please, we encourage you, if you like DIDs, and hopefully if you're on this call, you like DIDs, please take a moment and support in the ways that you can, either as a member, get your AC to vote in support, or if you're not a member, you can still voice your public support on that mailing list. It makes a difference. Okay, next up, we have a couple meetings starting next, is that Sunday, September 1st? So the Vienna Digital Identity Meetup, I'll drop the URL. This is going to be happening Sunday as a prelude to rebooting in Vienna. So a bunch of folks are getting together, and then the following day take a train up to Prague, which should be fun. Then we have Rebooting the Web of Trust, starts on Tuesday. We have a Monday night meetup that we're coordinating with. And then the following weekend, there are not one but two hackathons, one with the ActivityPub folks, and I'll drop that URL in. and another with our friends at HoloChain. So a lot of folks coming over to Prague. I wish I could go to both those hackathons, but I'll try and stop by and say hi at least. Okay, following that, TPAC, which is a W3C's Technical Plenary Advisory Council meeting, I think it's their big annual get-together, will be in mid-September, 16th through 20th. And then following that, back in Europe, the September 25th through 27th in September is My Data in Helsinki, which apparently will have a DID workshop, and I'll drop the My Data address in there. Okay, progress on action items. I'm going to open this up. I'm not sure where we're at from our last chair conversation. So we've just got one open. Discuss registries meta process. What are we doing next on that? I don't know if Kim or Chris are on the call.
Yeah, I can talk to that. I think the idea was just looking for volunteers to help with that. It's possibly a good starting task for someone. So we don't really have much to discuss about it at length, but there's Manu did a start of a process for registries, and we call it the meta process because it's sort of the general one behind how you would create a process for DID methods, key signatures, suites, credential status registries, things like that. So we do need to document that, and so that would be a good CCG work item to take on.
Great. Thanks, Kim. And I guess the deal is we have a couple of these registries. They already have a process. We're just trying to write up how they do things so that we can have a single meta process.
That's correct, yes.
Cool. It does sound like a pretty straightforward job. If someone wants to chip in and help out, I would be much appreciated. You can either chime in on the IRC or send an email to Kim or myself. Or jump onto that issue, which I'll put in the chat, and you can just assign yourself. Okay. Those are the action items we had tagged to go over today, which brings us to the prelude to our main content. So a quick report on the rubric work. So this started, as many of you know, at IAW. There were a couple of sessions, and then I wrote up a stab based on those notes. What might make sense in terms of a set of evaluatable criteria for evaluating DID methods. So you've got two different DID methods. We had a huge debate over whether or not DID methods needed to be decentralized in some mechanism. And it became clear that a lot of us have different definitions for what makes something decentralized. And so the notion of the rubric was to provide a framework, an objective framework, where we can allow any evaluator to ask the right questions of a DID method and evaluate on their own whether or not that DID method meets their needs. An example I like to give is the rubric is not to say that something is good or bad. It is not to say that you must be this tall to ride this ride. Rather, the goal of the rubric is to say, lots of people who care about decentralization think this question, this criteria, is useful. And we'll have some discussion of why different people think it's useful. But it may be to reinterpret that question about, you must be this tall to ride. The criteria is, how tall are you? Because some people have found that height is relevant to the safety with regard to riding a ride. Some rides, it may be that you have to be shorter than a given height because it's a kid's ride. And if an adult rides it, it might damage the ride. Or it might be that you have to be at least this tall because it's a roller coaster. And so if you're not large enough, the safety restraints can't handle you. So the goal of the rubric is not to pass judgment, but rather to provide objective metrics which any DID method could be evaluated against. And the evaluator then could decide whether it's a good fit for them. One of the things I wanted to share out, because it's been fairly fascinating. It's kind of a deep dive thing. You got to be kind of a word geek to really want to tease out these distinctions. One of them that came up fairly early on, which was fascinating to me but very cool, is the separation of the registry and the network. So in the DID conversation, we've been talking about the registry as the underlying place where the identifying records are held that ultimately link to, you know, some sort of DID documents in the resolution process. However, for Bitcoin, the registry and the net for BTCR, the registry and the network are the same thing. However, for two of the Ethereum-based DIDs that were being developed by folks who are part of the Rubrik work, the registry is actually a smart contract, and the network is Ethereum. So some of how the Rubrik was initially framed didn't pull out that distinction. So these are the kinds of things we're hoping to be able to tease out and have questions that make it clear that you can talk about the governance or the operation of the network, and that's subtly, sometimes slightly different than the governance or the operation of the registry. So that's going to continue on. A group of us are going to be at Rebooting and hope to create a paper there. The other update is a minor one about plurality. We've been talking about these as the rubrics, and we sometimes talk about each question or criteria as a rubric. That was incorrect. That was just sloppy language getting into this. So the entire document is, in fact, a single rubric, and the individual questions are criteria. So you'll see that language shifting for those of you who care about language, which may be a small percentage. But that's my update on where we are with that rubric work. Is there anyone on the queue waiting to make a comment? Dan, I see you on the queue. That may have been an old one.
That is an old one, but do you want to say anything about the relationship with the expected DID working group with respect to the rubric document or not?
Sure. So rubrics as a response to what does decentralized mean in decentralized identifiers is in the charter for as a deliverable, a non-normative deliverable of the DID working group. So just like the use case documents is a non-normative output of that group, we hope to see the rubric continue and continue with that working group. Dan, do you want to say anything other than that?
No, that was it.
Okay. I know that as the working group gets chartered, you know, things can change. But that is the intention, is hopefully this will move on over. And that's part of why we've shepherded this so far as a very informal conversation amongst co-authors for Rebooting. And we'll be operating under that intellectual property regime, which is, by attribution, CC by attribution. And then our intention is that we'll move into the newly formed working group, assuming that comes together. Okay, so we got through that in record time. Excellent. So we have roughly 40 minutes for the two topical topics of data shards and verifiable credentials in Solid, known as Solid VC. And we're going to start out with data shards with Chris Weber. And I'm going to drop the paper. And I know, Chris, you also put together a presentation. So I'll get that URL as well. You sent that out by email for folks who want to follow along. And we'll hand over Scribedom to Amy. Okay, there's the PDF for Chris's talk. Go ahead and run for a bit, Chris. I'll give you at least 10, maybe 15 minutes before I try and time box you.
Yeah. Can everybody hear me okay?
Yes.
Okay, great. So if you don't mind opening that presentation that Joe just linked, that PDF, we'll go through that. I am, in the interest of not having another real way to do it, I am going to just make a beep noise every time you should turn the page. So this is the presentation on data shards. It's don't have a lot of time, so hold your questions till the end. Beep. Okay, so data shards brings secure distributed storage primitives to the web. Well, what do we mean by that? Beep. Secure. Okay, so the secure aspect means that only intended recipients can see the messages, so it's private, which also makes it safer for node operators to help move things along the network. We'll get into that more later. And it's also secure against size of file attacks because everything's chunked. Beep. So distributed storage, what do we mean by that? Well, there are many different stores, so you could use a specific secure data hub to store your data shards in, or you could use your local file system, or you could stick it in a local database, or you could just stick it on a USB key and hand it to your friends, or you could distribute it over a gossip network /DHT. So nodes can host content, but we don't necessarily know what that content, they don't actually necessarily know what that content is. Beep. So as in terms of primitives for the web, by that we mean that it's supposed to be foundational, the way that HTTPS is foundational for live content. So we introduced two new URI schemas. One of them is IDSC, or immutable unchanging data, and the other one's MDSC, or mutable updatable changing data. So that's immutable data shards capability and mutable data shards capability, respectively. Both of those are URIs. And data can have the same name, but it can live in many different places. So if you upload a IDSC to, you know, your secure data hub, and then you download it and store it on your file system, and then your friend Craig, you know, downloads it and puts it, in his own local database, well, all of those things, you'll have the same URI no matter which of the places it lives in. Beep. Okay, so why not IPFS, GAT, et cetera? And that's basically because data shards encrypts everything. So this turns out to be critical for users because users deserve built-in privacy. So privacy should be the default everywhere. And node operators need to be able to, so seeing content actually can be a big problem. Sometimes it's better not to know. So if you imagine a community that has a bunch of volunteer postal workers who are all happily, you know, shipping around packages. Every morning they get out and they help ship the package from person to person. Then imagine if those packages were wrapped in saran wrap. And, you know, one day you're looking at a package and you see some stuff and you take a pause and you're like, should I really be delivering this? And then, you know, you get in the habit of starting to do that, you know, pretty regularly. And a bunch of people do, and then you start to feel a lot more. But the bigger pressure is that, you know, maybe the local government says, actually, you know what, you should be taking more responsibility for these packages you're shipping around. Here are, you know, some rules for what is and isn't allowed, and in fact, we're going to hold you liable for the contents. And this actually, you know, in this group of volunteers, I mean, who many people just might start to drop out, you know, and might not ship things around. So in fact, It adds a lot of unnecessary friction to the network and makes it a lot harder to be a node operator if you can see what the content is. So it would be much better if everything was wrapped in paper and not saran. So this means that layering encryption after the fact is unsafe. Clear text data is actually toxic to nodes on the network. So we want to start in an encrypted by default state. Beep. So IDSC example usage. So these are the immutable data shards, and we have real implementations for this for both the immutable and the mutable, but I'm just going to show the immutable today. So this is actual content taken from me doing a quick upload of this picture of a friend, and you see that it says, you know, debug, since I put it under verbose, where it's showing each one of these uploaded chunks. Now, each one of those chunks is each 32 kilobytes. The first one is the manifest, and once you retrieve this and decrypt it, that manifest will point you to the rest of the chunks. So you'll see at the last thing it spits out is the actual IDSC URI. And that IDSC URI says, you know, here it's got the hash of the initial chunk right after the 0p dot. We'll see this x9z blah, blah, blah. And after the next dot, it's actually got the key that you're going to use to decrypt it. So when you download it, you put in that same URI, and you'll notice the first thing that it does is it grabs a chunk that actually has that hash, and that one points to the rest of them, and it knows how to get it. It decrypts each one of those in turn and assembles it together in a complete photo. Okay, so but the thing is that the client is the one who actually has a union of both the initial hash that it retrieves things from and the key. And so even though it's fetching each one of those chunks, the servers that it's fetching it from don't actually know what those chunks represent. So, beep. Okay, so IDSCs seem fine for cat photos, but we might demand that we can update content, right? Beep. Okay, so this is where MDSCs come in. These are mutable data shard capabilities. So each mutable data shard capability is built on top of a new public-private key pair. So in fact, actually, the public key, the elliptic curve, we just dump it straight into the MDSC, and that is the name of the MDSC. It is the encoded public key. So the public key, the same way that a fingerprint ends up being the name of your PGP key or whatever, the name of this mutable file is actually the name of your public key. And we generate a new key pair for every MDSC, so they're not reused. So for every MDSC, we also have three different levels of access you can hand out. You have the verify-only capability, which this is what the registries who keep track of what updates have happened see. They know that updates have happened to these MDSCs, but they don't actually know what the updates represent. They can't even read them. And then there are the read plus verify capabilities, and these ones allow you to, you know, you can request, hey, give me the newest version, but you can also see what the contents are. And under the hood, they actually point to IDSC revisions. And then there's the write, which also gives you read and verify MDSC, which gives you the ability not only to read and also, you know, make sure that these really are the real updates, but you can also write up new updates. Okay. So you're like, well, wait a minute, what if multiple people have that write thing? You know, they could accidentally, you know, somebody could accidentally update from both their phone and from their desktop, or, you know, maybe somebody maliciously intentionally writes out two version twos because they want to confuse people. And that's completely correct. When it comes to Cap Theorem, we don't provide consistency out of the box, but you can layer it on. So there's a reason we don't provide consistency, because if you do it in the decentralized way, you basically have to do a blockchain or something like a blockchain. And we want to support garbage collectible content. You had a video game, and you've got a bunch of goblin monsters, and you're just killing goblin monsters left and right who are all represented by these MDSCs, then you don't want to bloat up a blockchain with all of those. So for some kinds of content, it's important to be able to garbage collect that content. However, in some other kinds of content, let's say, you know, somebody's, you know, self-sovereign identity or whatever like that, then actually the ordering of events may be possible. It's possible to build a blockchain that actually does specify here the official order, or you could even use a centralized oracle. So maybe you have a social security agency that only accepts one version two for this MDSC, right? So you could do things that way. That's your choice. We could standardize some ways to be able to do that, but it's not out of the box right now. Beep. So, okay, example uses. So any document you might otherwise keep on the web, or, you know, a more resilient federated social network. So this is actually the motivating example for me. So I even wrote an implementation of this that showed two nodes on a federated social web thing. This happens currently on the federated social web, where content, a node can go down and people are no longer able to access any of their own content, or maybe can't even interact with the content that their friends had. So this allows you to be able to actually, instead of storing it as an HTTP URI, you can store it as an IDSC or an MDSC URI, and then that content can survive. And if you use an MDSC for people's ActivityPub profiles, you can actually switch out over time what inbox they point to. So I'm currently posted on Octodon.social. If Octodon.social goes down, I could push out an MDSC update towards the network and point it at IDSC. So what else can we do? Since these are valid web URIs, we could also use them to store verifiable credentials, and we could even actually point to verifiable credentials that are stored in this mechanism, and they would actually even be a viable DID. We could make these a DID mechanism, right? So if you think about it, if you store a DID document in an MDSC, and then you just keep doing updates, that's a way to be able to do updates. We could make a DID resolution mechanism that actually uses data shards. And, you know, if you wanted to put that on a blockchain, we could decide to do that. If we decided, you know, we're not going to do that, we could decide that way. But it's perfectly viable to be able to build that on top of this. If you're talking about key recovery, you'd have to use Shamir Magic Secrets or something like that to be able to recover the key. But in general, yes, it would be possible to build DIDs on top of this if we wanted to. And I think that this actually is a better foundation for secure data hubs. But it's not limited to secure data hubs. You know, you could store this on a secure data hub, but then you could also store it, you know, on a USB key that you can't send to your friend or whatever. Beep. Okay, so conclusions. So we need data shards because the live web is too fragile. Too much data people care about lost. You know, we shouldn't have another burning of the Library of Alexandria that is GeoCities, right? You know, people really care about their stuff. If they want to keep it around, they should be able to keep it around. But on the other hand, other existing content address systems don't necessarily support privacy or unsafe to node administrators. And I will say that data shards as ideas have been pretty much completely lifted from another content address system called Tahoe LAFS, but they didn't have the support for a global system like this. So data shards in many ways provides both the support for privacy and safety for node administrators, but it's also designed to be global, unlike Tahoe's specific local clusters. And so it also provides a fundamental secure content address storage primitive that we can build other things on top of, the same way that HTTP ends up being a fundamental live connection primitive that allows us to build many other types of things. So there's a website, datashards.net. We're still in an early stage. And I hope that answered some questions, and I hope, and I'm open to answering other questions if there's time, which I know I've gone over.
Hello.
Yeah, I guess I guess I'm the one supposed to be doing acting, so let me check the queue. I guess I'll act Shivam.
Yeah, hi, this is Shivam here.
Go for it.
Hello. Yeah, so basically my question is like, so the solution which you are creating in form of data shards, so that is more oriented to credentials and secure data hubs, or it's like something similar to the like we use, so is it oriented to verifiable credentials and secure hubs, or something else, like what the solution which we are creating, we are actually creating this in keeping in mind about the verifiable credentials and secure data hubs? That is my question, actually.
So let me just see if I can repeat the question back to you. Was the question, how is this different from the secure data hubs work, or is it directly tied in?
So basically the question is, there we also have something like IPFS, right? So
okay.
So the solution which we are creating in form of data shared is getting created by keeping secure data hubs and verifiable credentials in mind, or we are just creating a generalized solution?
Right. So if you're creating a generalized solution with secure data hubs, I mean, I would like this to be a generalized solution that is the foundation on which things like secure data hubs and stuff are built. So I'm not necessarily familiar with the work that you've done with your secure data hubs. The discussion that I've had with the Digital Bazaar folks is we've been discussing whether or not it would be, you know, acceptable to build the kind of this type of thing underneath what they're hosting on the secure data hubs, but that's, you know, hasn't moved forward at all yet. So the reason that I've been working on this is that I want something that is general, outside of a specific, you know, web store, or specifically something you stick on a USB key, or specifically any of those things. So it would be really great if we could get convergence on something we all agree on is, you know, the base structure for stuff that could live offline or online or et cetera. Does that answer your question to any degree?
Yeah, thank you.
Okay, great. Marcus, I think you're next.
Yes, thanks for the presentation. It's very, very impressive, I think. It could be used for a lot of things. I just have a short question, I hope. What's the relationship between this and the HashLink work?
Right. So we've had some conversations. I've had some conversations with the Digital Bazaar folks. Right now, you'll see I'm using a more, if you look in the presentations on the upload example, you see I use a more old school approach, which is the URN colon and then the name of the hash mechanism. So it would be completely possible for us to use HashLink instead, and I have discussed that at some points with Digital Bazaar, and we are not doing that currently. Part of that is actually because of the serialization mechanism. They're using CBOR. I don't have access to a CBOR implementation. But maybe that's something we can resolve. I'd love to actually converge on a unified hash, content-addressed hash mechanism. So it would be totally possible to get convergence in that. I think we just need to talk about it.
Cool.
So next is Dave Longley. Go ahead, Dave.
Hey, Chris. Thank you very much for this presentation. This is very cool stuff. I'm also very interested in figuring out where we can get some convergence. And I think there's some good places where we might be able to layer this technology. One of the things I want to caution that I've mentioned before with you, Chris, is I have a big concern around the fact that people often don't think about encryption having a shelf life. And encryption does have a shelf life. If you had been using this system and you were using DES, for example, and the system existed 15 years ago, everyone would be reading all of the content that survived on a network if it was all shared, for example, across a bunch of public nodes. So I'm a little bit concerned about not putting protections around those sorts of situations or using this technology where there's a network of nodes where supposedly they're not able to read the data. That's true today, but 10 years from now, that data can now be seen by anyone who was participating in collecting it. So that doesn't mean you can't use a system like that. It just means that there's caveats around it. It's sort of the same reason that you don't put encrypted data on a blockchain. And so that's one of my main concerns around a particular use case of this technology, but that isn't that is not necessarily an issue for it if we use other kinds of layering.
Right. So I wanted to reply to this. Dave and I have talked about this quite a bit off channel here. I actually had slides for this, but I originally thought this talk was 40 minutes long, and then I shortened it, so I cut out a bunch of stuff. So yes, encryption has a shelf life. And as you may know, and as you may have noticed in the slides, I said that there are many store mechanisms, right? There are store mechanisms for where you could, it's agnostic to the particular store mechanism. So you could store this on, you know, a specific backup service that you semi-trust, or you could store things on a completely global system, or you could just store them on USB keys that you deliver over Sneakernet, right? And it's up to you what your threat level is, but you're completely right that we need to make clear to people that encryption has a shelf life, and that eventually stuff that's safe today may not be safe tomorrow. That said, I think it's even if we're doing only mostly public content, I still think it's better to use something like this than IPFS, and the reason is the safety of node administrators, right? The safety of people helping route things on the network, for the very example of the postal system delivery thing that I described earlier, or at least semi-public content, we could say, right? So, and I think that this is like, I think the IPFS folks have done amazing work, but I would not host an IPFS node because I don't want to be able to see what, I don't want to be able to help be a postal worker that's shipping content around the network and then see what it is that I'm helping ship around, because that makes me more nervous about the liability of that content. And for the same reason that it's more dangerous to be a Tor endpoint than it is to be a Tor exit node than it is to be a Tor intermediate node. So I agree that those concerns are there.
Chris, let me put a pin on that. We've got to wrap up your part of this so we can get over to Coyote, and there are three other folks on the queue.
Yep. Okay. All right. I'm going to ask you, Joe.
Okay, great. So a quick question. Just have you thought about where this goes in terms of standards?
Do you think
it's W3C or IETF or something else?
So that's part of the reason why we, you know, submitted this as a rebooting paper and why Serge and I are on this call today is, you know, we're this is something we've been experimenting locally over the last year, but we are interested in trying to bring this down a standards route. Is the CCG a good path to incubate that? I would love it if that's the case. I don't actually, you know, but that's a conversation for us to have, you know, with this community or with whatever other community.
Okay, great.
So Ryan Grant.
Hi, Chris. I guess the system relies on Crystal servers to registries to find the data once given a URN. How are those kept censorship resistant? How censorship resistant are they? Is that an unsolved problem or any theory on that?
So I think what we could say here is, you know, if you, so it's about as censorship resistant as how many different avenues you have to be able to find out about updates, right? So if an attacker is able to, let's say you've got version 2 of a document and this other person really wants to get version 3 to you, right? If there are 5 avenues through which you connect to getting that, that your updates, and all 5 of them either don't see the update or are blocked from having the update, then absolutely you won't get that update, right? But it could be, you know, if somebody adds number 6, then you can get that update, right? So I think it's pretty similar to the kind of challenges that people have in other mechanisms. I think what you might want to say is, well, you know, if a few of these stores end up being very easily censored by some intermediary, maybe you add some other ones that are harder.
Thanks.
Yep. So Jonathan?
Yeah, just to address some of your concerns, as you know, I'm heavily involved in the IPFS project, and what you described so far is basically IPFS. And mm-hmm. So I think, if you were to write in your own node, you only pin those things that you actually want to pin. So it's not like you're willy-nilly replicating data on the network. So there are safeguards, and this is what Filecoin is about, which is encrypted data that incentivizes the storage of and dissemination of data. So it's So I'm just reading your paper now, and you have some interesting points, but I think there are just a few misunderstandings of what IPFS is.
Okay. Maybe we should hash this out at rebooting. Will you be there?
No, unfortunately, I'll be in France.
Oh, okay. Well, then maybe we should hash this off offline. I'd be interested in chatting.
Cool.
Okay. Thank you very much, Chris. I appreciate that introduction and back and forth. Our next presentation is going to be Coyote Kizuke. Am I saying that right? Who's going to talk about Solid VC and the work he's been doing over there. He submitted a paper to rebooting on that topic, which he just dropped into the chat.
Right.
And
awesome.
Go ahead, Kaede.
Great. Thank you very much, Joe. Hello, everyone. My name is Kaede Ezike, and I have been loosely involved. Oh, sorry. Kaede Ezike. I can type that out. And I have been loosely involved with the W2C CCG since 2018, and I became involved through my work during my master's program, where I was working with the Decentralized Information Group within MIT, and I was tasked with a platform to basically take on any role within the verifiable credentials mm-hmm. ecosystem, and to allow for anyone to be able to the issue a credential, receive a credential, verify a credential. And we decided to develop this platform within the context of Solid because of the different properties, beneficial properties that it has, including your own personal data store, known as the Personal Online Data Store, POD, P-O-D, and other elements of it that really allows the user to be able to separate application logic from data storage so that they're able to control our data a little more. And I would love to get a little bit more into what this is, but for the sake of time, I'm just going to put this link here. This is what would be considered to be the, if you will, the authoritative link. I mean, recently, Zawa's management has been migrated into MRUF since last year. And so more or less, I would say that this is like the authoritative source for all things Zawa. So that's a bit of a setup. I want to just, basically the format of this presentation will be a demo. I wasn't really sure if I'd have enough time to do much more than that, but I wanted to give a demo of the platform, taking on different roles, and the context of the demo that I'm giving will be the basically the life cycle, if you will, of a driver's license. And so I will start off by doing this. I'll put a link in case you're interested in either now or later sort of installing this and playing around with yourself. This is the link that you would download the app, the platform from. And so,
let me just interrupt real quick. There are some audio problems. I don't know if there's room for you to change anything, but just to give you a heads up.
Oh, is this this a little better?
It will take the effort. I have a feeling it's your downlink, but Chris is having a hard time describing.
What about this?
Let's try that.
Okay.
And Chris, feel free to speak up if it doesn't improve enough for you to describe.
Okay.
Go ahead, Cody.
Okay. Thank you. So that's the link that I just posted, and sort of the first thing that you do when you download this link is you run npm install that allows you to get basically install all the dependencies. And there are a number of different important dependencies involved, including, for example, the dish and LDSignatures library, which is used extensively for signing credentials, as well as RDFFlib, which is a linked data module that's used extensively as well. Other things like that. It also sets up your remote pod. And so basically in the platform, in the Solid ecosystem, individuals have their own accounts, and they can store data in their accounts. And within Solid VC, I allow for the ability to basically store important information in different strategic locations in your pod. So for example, in your profile document, which is, if you will, kind of the index of your account, where it's public information that people can see about your account. Particularly, there's the ability to see the information that's actually there. And for example, there's ways to store your public key in your document, as well as other things like that. And so, and also the ability to store a revocation list or a credentials management folder that will allow for you to be able to do that as well. And so I'm actually realizing that, this is probably something I should have realized earlier, that the demo is a visual demo, and so it's actually, it's just occurring to me that a lot of things that I'm saying you won't actually be able to see. This is a little bit unfortunate, I should have thought about that. But I don't know if there's really a way to get around that within the time that we have, but I'm going to ask you to bear with me at least for now, and if you want, you can follow along. And you would basically just install the npm install, and if you have a Solid account, you'd just be able to enter your web ID as well as your password, and then that will authenticate you to your platform or to the account. And then from there, you'll be able to set up what folder should my key live in. So that would be stored in a location in your pod. And then that would also be pointed to from your personal document. And so you have a statement in your personal document that would say, this is where my public key lives within my pod. And so, and that would be useful for when you verify information later on. And then additionally, there's the ability to indicate where does my document that we have, a folder that we have called a revocation folder, I'm calling it, that keeps track for each credential that's issued on the platform. It keeps track of a list of, it keeps track of the status of the credential. And so if the credential is issued by the issuer, then the issuer would, the status of it would stay active on the credential for the file that lives within that revocation folder for that credential. If it's revoked later on, which is also a functionality that we provide, then it would say revoked. And so I guess it's kind of addressing you verbally, but on the platform, you come to the platform as a subject, you have the ability to select, you have the ability to review or request, I should say, for a credential, and you select the credential type. So there's education, finance, et cetera. In this case, it would be transportation. And once you select that, you can then include the title and the issuer ID, which really comes down to a web ID for the issuer, and then an optional description for the credential. Please give me my credential, something like that. Please give me my driver's license. And then from there, you'd click request credential. The issuer would then receive that in their inbox, which is provided by my platform as well. And then they would be able to basically decide if the information in this credential enough. So basically, when you're requesting for the credential, it's encouraged for you to include in the description, which is optional. But it's still available. Include information that would be actually verify if the credential is a valid, if the individual who's requesting for the credential actually has the criteria that's needed. And so for in this case, for example, it might include perhaps like including information such as your image or other sorts of data that is very to be known. For example, information that sort of ascertains that you have. We did a 5-hour course, for example, things of that nature. And if the issuer deems that the information is sufficient, then they would proceed to the issue tab and they would issue the credentials to the issuer. They would basically just input the credential type of transportation, the web ID of the individual, and then a sort of an RDF that would say that the individual owns this particular driver's license. It issues to the subject, and the subject now would get this in the inbox. And now when they have it in their inbox, it instantly stored in the user's solid pod remotely. But it is possible for the issuer to download the credential right away onto their machine and actually delete from their remote pod even if they wanted to, because the information that you need is really contained within the mobile sort of mobile credential. And so at a later point in time, if they want to be able to verify, to say they get pulled over by a cop, they want to verify to the cop that they actually do have a license, the cop would visit the verifier interface and they would see, they would basically see that well, before they do that, the subject would have to share via the share interface that the credential, either from their local machine or from the URI that they had stored it previously. And so when they share that, the verifier, the cop, would be able to go to their inbox. They'd be able to see that there is a credential there waiting for them. And they could then, they would basically then be able to enter in the URI of that credential and then verify credential. And then depending on whether or not the credential is valid, whether or not it has good integrity, so whether or not the signature is actually correct, for example, they would then receive an interface that says it's correct. So that would also check, for example, that replication that I was earlier. That replication was pointed to by the credential and store it with the issuer, will check that it actually has an active status. For example, when it's revoked, then it would not be valid or it would not be valid. So that is more or less what the platform is able to do. I wanted to show some other nuances after downloading the credential to be able to modify the content of the credential. That messed up the integrity and ultimately surfaced it to the verifier that the credential is now valid. These are things that I worked out perfectly in my head, but just realizing just that I started that, I can't really show that visually. And so I'm wondering if maybe at a later point in time I can provide a link to a video. Actually, I do have a video somewhere. It's pretty big.
Okay, why don't you go ahead and look up that link to the video? We only have 5 minutes left, and I know we have Kim on the queue. Kim, you want to go ahead?
Yeah, so thank you for this presentation. One thing I wanted to mention is a lot of us are new to Solid, and so I think people would be interested as well in hearing more about some of the basics, like, you know, what's a pod and what's a profile and how do verifiable credentials fit into all of that. So basically the idea of the profile can be a target of a verifiable credential, but I think some of those basics are kind of the things people would like to hear about as well.
Right, right. Absolutely. And I'll admit that probably there's others in the group that can use speak even better. I can still speak very great about it, but it's also, if possible, Dimitri or Amy. But the basically, Solid, so it doesn't come to something like that. So there's the notion of a pod, and the pod is this where it's basically where your personal data lives. And it is structured kind of like a file system. And there are different folders, there are different sort of strategic folders within there. There's an inbox, there's a public folder, and there is other types of folders that you're able to receive that has different sort of types of visibility for people and access rights. And you're also able to set access rights for different files and different files basically as to like which applications can access which folders on what basis, read, write, update, et cetera. And basically what the profile document that I was referring to earlier is it's located in sort of like a, it's also located in a public location in your pod under your profile. It's called a card, and it's basically just information that you'd like for people to know about you as represented in RDF. So it has just basically a bunch of statements about you saying like, hey, my name is Kaede Ezike, my email address is this, et cetera, et cetera. So the reason why it was relevant for when I was speaking about it earlier is that during the setup sort of program that you run and when you first use the platform, part of what it does is it updates that, it authenticates you to your Solid pod from the terminal, and it updates your profile document such that it points to a public key that you store in your pod during setup, so that whenever somebody wants to verify a credential, they would basically look at the issuer, that the issuer ID on the credential, and like, you reference the profile document that individual, and they search for the key, the public key statement, and then that would turn them to where the public key is within the pod. And there's probably so much more that there's more time.
Well, thank you very much, Coyote. Any other questions? We have one more minute. I'm not seeing anyone on the queue. So thank you very much, Coyote, and thank you, Chris. Much appreciated for your work and for your presentations today. I may not have mentioned earlier that we do not have a call next week because many of us will be in Prague at Rebooting the Web of Trust. So with that, not seeing anyone jump on queue. I think that's a wrap. Thank you all very much.
Thank you all very much.